and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is February 11th, 2025. And this is episode 500. Ding, 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 ding,
500.
Ding, ding. Yeah, we did it. Ma, yeah. Pa, we did it. 500 episodes. Yeah. We is all of our subscribers because this is 100% dependent on the subscribers and the whole community. But dang, we done did it.
It's amazing. And the way that pays off is like when something important and morally charged happens, like the destruction of Gaza, where, I mean, I'm not saying we're strong enough to make a difference. We'll never make a difference, but at least we can speak out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I'm quite proud of our, you know, episodes starting with right after October 7th. We took some heat at first, but I think we took the right side, and sort of, you know, the overwhelming majority of our subscribers, and we had some great guests. So it's really one of the finest moments from all of them, from Muin Rabini up through John Elmer and Ali Abu Nima, who was arrested in Switzerland recently for being Palestinian, basically. And a lot of other great guests on that horrible war. Yeah, so for the 500th anniversary, we were talking about what would be good for this. I mean, you know, we looked up 1525. There is one war event, at least that I was able to find, but it's because, of course, they're always so skewed towards Europe. All the events, basically, Europe skewed. But the only one that I could find that, you know, we'll get to at some point with Annibale was the Battle of Pavia. In the Italian wars. And another thing I saw, I think Jacob Fugger died, or Fugger is probably how he's really pronounced that.
Is he the banker?
The plutocrat banker, who in many ways kind of sparked the whole Luther rebellion. You know, it's a long story, but he's kind of an interesting guy, But
then there's also
the Warner. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, there's also, and I was sort of pushing for this, there's also the fact that among the Trump administration's many moves, and they have more moves than a three-card Monty dealer. I mean, they're always doing some patter and some little cheating hand motions and honking a horn and just doing every distraction possible. There has been a lot of talk about Canada and Greenland is also ours. Everything is ours. As Ted Hughes said long ago, I kill where I please because it is all mine. That was Ted Hughes being the voice of a hawk.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah.
I got to say, he was right about hawks, man. We have a red-tailed hawk in our neighborhood, and He is just so cool. I can't.
Yeah.
It's like I'm a little nervous for the kittens, but he is really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not do-gooders, the old hawks.
No. I saw him pith a chipmunk right on our lawn, and we caught it on our camera. And he just it was a blur. And the next thing we knew, there's this little chipmunk twitching on the ground. And my wife, who's big animal rights person, got a rescue. There is an animal welfare rescue, and we saved a bat this way, but they took a look at the chipmunk and they said, like, you're not putting him on a freaking, you know, life support system in a wheelchair, like, you know.
An ex-chipmunk, like the old skit.
Yes, poor guy.
I know, besides, hawks got to eat too.
Yeah, it's how it is, yeah. Yeah. They don't go shopping at Wegmans, you know.
No.
So you were saying about this Trump tweeting out these maps of the United States in which Canada is colored in red, white, and blue,
stars and stripes. You know, the stripes and the stars intermittently popping up on those northern islands in the north of Canada. And I have no idea, personally, whether Trump or anybody with him means this stuff. maybe it's just a way of getting Trudeau riled and, you know, the right pious people in Ontario riled. Who knows? But I thought it would be a good time to review the War of 1812, which is a war which was fought in large part along the Canadian-American border. Mm-hmm. And a very interesting war. I did a series of articles on it long ago, before we were doing the show. And it's also a war that featured every possible kind of fighting, from guerrilla war on the western territories of the United States to flat-out naval battles all over the Atlantic, and full-scale battles in which the U.S. generally did very badly against the British regular army. The scope of this fight was extraordinary, especially because the Americans didn't have a lot of money or power projection means, mm-hmm. but they managed to project their power rather well, partly because the United States had already become an exporting country, a maritime country. It was overwhelmingly along the eastern seaboard. America's inland expansion was really yet to come. But I thought the battles along the Canadian border are interesting enough that for them alone, we can talk about the War of 1812 in a timely way. Because, mm-hmm. you know, we're all about timeliness. God knows.
Yeah, yeah. And the war, your Warner series on the War of 1812, which is like, it's both a minor war. It is an interesting war. It's a big-ish war for Americans just because, you know, I don't know, because they still wore coats and top hat, you know, three-cornered hats, and we love those wars in history classes. Although they don't really teach us much about, like, you know about the War of 1812. You know that the White House was burned by John Bull and Andrew mm-hmm. Jackson pulled off, like, a late-game flea flicker. But, like, they don't really teach us much. So your series, I think, you know, at least in the last, in sort of the post-exile years, your series that you did for NSFW Corp, I think, is one of the most popular and best things you've written, like, as a series. People loved it because it's very funny, too. I mean, there's a lot of...
It was a funny war.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some wonderful irony. Like, guess who the American patriots were saying we should all stick together and stop the English tyranny from opposing our commerce? That was the South. Yeah. And guess what state almost seceded, came very, very close to seceding? Rhode Island. Yeah. It's one moment of distinction before Dumb and Dumber. And it's really extraordinary. I mean, it's a good lesson. Like, as Jack Vance would say, humans are as plastic as wax. They'll assume any shape based on the circumstances. So when the circumstances change, New England will be secessionist and the South will be radically integrationist. Well, not in the racial sense, but in the, you know, the U.S. is one country kind of way. Mm-hmm. And all this came about because England, or rather the U.K., I'm not sure it was the U.K. yet, I don't know. Maybe that was around 1800, mm-hmm. active union. I don't know. But was in a death struggle with revolutionary France. And I still don't know how France managed to lose that war. And it hurts me on a daily basis. I'll just be walking down the street and say, just, you know, fuck Bonaparte. Just build some barges. Pick a sunny day and go sail across the channel. But no, he had to get fancy and invade Russia. But anyway,
yes.
So, yeah, I mean, 1793.
Sorry, have you seen the Napoleon movie yet?
No, I mean, I do think
with Joaquin,
Phoenix is good.
He's always really good. Yeah, and he's very good as Napoleon, given the constraints of the script in the movie. It's actually not a bad movie. It has some great fight scenes. It's fun and funny how the Napoleon that he has is somebody who's got a lot of kind of, I don't know, like classic conservative grievances. He's being humiliated all the time and having to prove himself.
Is it a height thing?
Yeah, an ambition thing, a height thing, a Corsican thing, a love thing. The movie was kind of, it wasn't bad. You know, it does entertain. And the battle scenes, again, are pretty good. But God damn it, when he decides to go to Russia, it's like, why? It's just, the other guys are just over that little creek there.
Yep.
Why?
Yeah. But anyway, so they're at war from 1793. France is overwhelmingly the land power of Europe in the way that the Soviet Union was at the end of World War II. And the only chance that Great Britain had, much like the U.S. in the Cold War, was to be a maritime power, although the U.S. added air power to that and money power. So that really messes with the United States as a country that's very interested in exporting stuff. I mean, the business of America is business, as Calvin Coolidge said much later. And they can't export their cotton freely to continental Europe because Britain and France have boycotted each other. Like, the British declare nothing is to be imported from continental Europe. Uh-huh. The French declare nothing is to be imported to or exported from Britain. Right. So the two great powers in the world at this time are imposing a lot of stresses on global commerce. And global commerce was very much a thing by this point. I mean, the West Indies were massive, massive. And India was also a big, big part of the global trade network. And this disrupts everything, but it disrupts in a way that's good for New England and bad for the American South, so that you get this really, really ironic secession movement in New England, which comes in a few states, especially Rhode Island, within a few votes of seceding formally from the United States, which is kind of ridiculous since it, you know, it's Rhode Island, but Rhode Island had a 70% share in the slave trade in the 18th century, and it soon converted that to becoming a de facto supply base for the Royal Navy when the U.S. goes to war with Britain, and they made a ton of money. And the U.S. just didn't have the spare ships or soldiers to crack down on them. And this got memory hold eventually. And, you know, Rhode Island was part of the loyal northern tier of states. But it wasn't always that way.
Yeah. Yeah, and Rhode Island is like, I don't know, New England elite preppy. That's what I think of anyway. Isn't it Newport, right? Newport's their big shishi city.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, in fact, I went with my family to a big 18th century ship display in maybe Newport, somewhere up there. It all gets confused for me. But the Royal Navy was, at this point, the bulwark of the British Empire. The French army was supreme on the continent. The British had to pick their fights, which they did eventually, and they're very good at picking their fights in Spain, and they bled the French army there. But then they start to have their own problems in a way that's really, really interesting, and that we should have done some episodes on by now, because it's one of the biggest events, or the almost events that have ever happened. And this was in 1797, when Royal Navy crews, C-R-E-W-S, who surprisingly were, you know, kind of sick of being beaten and flogged and fed moldy biscuits and hanged for the least offense, actually mutiny in massive numbers at naval bases in Britain. And this terrorizes the British elite. They've been consuming French radical propaganda, and French radical propaganda was very effective. Mm-hmm. I mean, William Blake, of all people, got arrested for saying, "I hope the French do invade." I mean, for God's sake, William Blake, crazy poet, has the sense to realize that they can just invade. Mm-hmm. But does Bonaparte? No. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so for a long time, for months, it looks like the Royal Navy will sail its ships to French ports and change sides. And it took a lot of treachery and a lot of hangings before they can put a stop to that. Part of the really interesting angle to this is that some of the agitation was done by the United Irishmen, who were a Protestant-dominated but all-faith revolutionary organization that would start a revolutionary war in Ireland in 1798 and get completely massacred. But they were agitating among the sailors. The French were agitating among the sailors. Most of all, the sailors were thinking about things for themselves. I mean, I don't know why Kronstadt gets all the publicity.
Yeah.
I think it's a...
Because Eisenstein or something like that.
Yeah,
like
maybe.
And stuff, yeah.
And a lot of misguided Russophilia. I mean, there's sensible Russophilia, and then there's misguided Russophilia. But anyway, this was a much, much more important naval mutiny that could have changed the world forever.
Correct me if I'm wrong, that they're press ganged, right? I mean, most of the crew are press ganged, or is that wrong?
I don't know how many of them were.
Okay.
I don't know what percentage were.
Okay.
But the elite doesn't really care how the Navy gets its crews.
Right.
And nobody wants to be a sailor unless they're at death's door or running from the cops.
Yeah.
There's a famous epiphany in the Parliament, almost a century later, when they're talking about abolishing flogging in the Navy. And remember, this is at the end or late in the 19th century, and one of Parnell's party, who are not very numerous, but they're very clever and very powerful, sends out and says, "Get me a cat of nine tails. I want to bring it in here." And they bring a cat of nine tails that's just covered with old blood, with, you know, nails in its 12 or 13 strands of braided leather. And they pass it around the house. And the House had been saying all sorts of clever British parliamentarian things like, as soon ship brandy and women as have a ship of the line without the cat, you know, the cat But then they pass this around like show and tell, and with no comment, with no further discussion, they outlaw the use of the cat of nine tails in the British Navy. So, you know, they just decided they didn't want to know about how people got recruited for naval crews. Right. I mean, there's a famous, and not just naval crews, for cannon fodder in the Army as well, because there's a famous technique where the press gang gets drunks and gives them one extra glass, which they just glug without thinking. And then there's a shilling at the bottom, and it's like, well, you drank the king's shilling. And if there's any objection after that, one of them just bops him on the head and wakes up seasick the next morning. So they got sick of this, And it almost happened. And it would have been one of the most extraordinary things in the world, but it didn't. And eventually the French army destroyed itself by the invasion of Russia, and the British Navy emerged as the dominant power of the 19th century. But we're getting
another example of Yahweh as Old Man Lebowski. Your revolution is over. Condole every fucking time.
Yeah. It does start to feel a little Schopenhauerian after a while. And just the news today from Trump, it's just getting me down pretty badly. And I try not to do that.
You mean about him threatening to unleash hell on Gaza as if they haven't already experienced it?
Yeah,
that's the weird part. But they already have a bunch of private American contractors there in the Nitzarim corridor. Like they're showing videos of there's already special forces under private contractor. And I get the sense maybe this is something we've missed. There's a not insignificant faction that is really wants to openly and directly participate in the stomping and looking for an excuse.
All right. Well, we'll have to.
Yeah, that's for another show.
Get something on that then.
Yeah.
But no, it's more like Trump always does the overkill, and it's like, we're going to sell your land. We're going to kill you. We're going to never let you come back. We're going to. But anyway, then there is, because of all this trade tension and poaching of crews, because, as I said, nobody wants to serve on a ship of the line. So British warships board commercial ships and say, you've got some of our sailors there. You know, everybody talk and we'll see who has a British accent. And they pull sailors they consider British or to have been British sailors off American ships, which is a real outrage to the American nation, which sees its shipping as inviolate. And a lot of money is riding on those ships, too. So in the early 19th century, 1807 in particular, there are outright battles between U.S. and Royal Navy ships. And it's already apparent that the U.S. Navy is not bad. That was, it was by far the best of the armed services at this point. And it always had been, going back to the Revolutionary War, where, I don't know, I don't think younger people grew up on these legends, but I grew up on John Paul Jones. Like, Mark, do you remember the John Paul Jones slogan that Bugs Bunny adopts?
Which one is that? See, the John Paul Jones, the first one in my mind is always the bass player in Led Zeppelin. So, but no, it was, but of course,
heresy.
I know. So that might be a Bugs line. Heresy, you know, this means war. So no, go ahead and tell me.
I have not yet begun to fight.
Yes.
Because he said that to the commander of the Serapis when his frigate had blown the hell out of John Paul Jones's frigate, which was called the Bonhomme Richard. And Jones wrote on the note that he was going to send back, "I have not yet begun to fight."
Cool.
And it turned out to be true, because Jones was one of these 18th century scary, but if you have him on your side, really magnificent Scots guys who were fearsome, just plain fearsome. And eventually one of his Marines gets up in one of the masts, throws a lit grenade, basically a cannonball with a fuse in it, into the Serapis's hold. It blows up, and suddenly it's the Serapis that's surrendering. And Jones has what was really the first victory for a smaller ship against a larger British ship of the line in many generations. I mean, they were stunned. So the U.S. Navy was beginning, thanks to mainly Scottish or British exports, like Jones, to come into its own. The army was not so much. But there are all these battles everywhere in the ocean. And the election of James Madison then becomes the next stage. And this is where we could really use Bill Hoagland to talk to us about this, because in 1809, James Madison is sworn in as fourth president. And James Madison is a lot like the rest of them. You know, he's very accomplished, very intelligent. He's also an operator, very much an operator, and a real estate guy. And Madison is particularly interested, as Washington was, as a lot of people were, in the lands beyond the Appalachians. But the problem is the British hold those lands at the moment, and they have persuaded the Native American tribes of those lands that they are protecting them from the greedy American colonists. And there's some truth to that. There's also some imperial manipulation to it. So Madison and the people he has dinner with conclude that it would be a good time for a war, because there's an awful lot of acreage in there. And once you cut down all the trees, it's going to be some great farmland. So with all this mix of motives, sleazy and semi-patriotic and just, I suppose, genuinely patriotic, war becomes more and more likely. But it's been a while since the U.S. had a war. And what they're used to is fighting on a small scale in the wilderness against various Native American confederations. But finally, they decide to feel too offended at all this high-handed seizure of ships and crews on the high seas. So June 1812, they declare war on Great Britain. And, you know, crowds go around smashing anti-war newspapers, another great American tradition. And an American general named William Hull invades Canada from Detroit. Again, it's, you know, there's supposedly a Vietnamese saying or joke that if you give a Chinese a spear for his birthday, he starts marching south. And the American experience is like, or the Canadian experience, if you like, is if you give an American a musket, he starts marching north.
Yeah.
So William Hull turns out to be one of the worst generals who ever lived.
People should know, first of all, real quickly, that Detroit, which is, you know, I'm sure they've all heard of Detroit, in Michigan, but it is right on the border. It is a border town with Canada.
So, yeah. And Hull is a disastrous general. One thing you'll see in this war is that there are some great naval commanders. There are some great irregular force commanders in the American army, but the regular commanders are just terrible. They're often Revolutionary War generals who have now gotten way too old, or they were just never any good in the first place. So, Hull,
see, a Stalin purge could have taken care of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Because, I mean, I've slowly come around to the thought that Stalin knew what he was doing. Like, get rid of the dead wood.
It's like in there was one of those new Planet of the Apes movies, a really good one. There was a kind of insurgent Koba, and he's like he's supposed to be ugly.
Koba.
And although he's supposed to be the bad guy in it, he's actually like, we were yelling out in the theater, Koba was right. Koba was right, because he was. So anyway, yeah.
Yeah. Wow, they're getting all literate over there, aren't they? I mean, I don't like that. I liked them when they were less literate. But anyway, so Hull eventually returns to Detroit. British forces then take Detroit. He surrenders, and he's put on trial for treason. And his defense is basically, I'm not a traitor. I'm just incompetent.
Yes. I love that, though. It's very Yosemite Sam. Attack! And then 2 minutes later, retreat! Detroit.
That's pretty much what they did. And it's really interesting that every generation of Americans, including Trump, has this delusion that Canada is going to be a pushover. Mm-hmm. And I don't quite know why, because the reasons keep changing, but Canada never seems to be a pushover. They make several attempts during the Revolutionary War, and they do occupy Quebec City for a little while, but then they get chased out of it, and they do another invasion in the Revolutionary War. It fails again. In 1812, they try to attack northward again. Disaster. There's a lot of indecisive naval battles on the Great Lakes. They do a little better against the British forces there. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem like there's a pushover. And then in the aftermath of the Civil War, the Fenians, of all people, the Irish revolutionaries, try to attack Ontario, and they get pretty splattered.
Why did they attack Ontario? Just on general principles, as the fellow would say?
It was a foolish idea because they were addicted to conventional warfare. Mm. But it took Michael
just
Call.
Because it's a British call. Yeah. Right. Sorry. Yeah. Obviously.
Right. Yeah. It took Michael Collins really to show the Irish that they should stop doing these glorious suicidal last stands and just send people to kick the door in and shoot the spies.
Yeah.
While they were sleeping, or as Collins put it, put out their eyes. They were addicted to conventional war against the British Empire.
That's not how you beat them.
Not in Canada either. It's like they're going to get in a panic at their London club because somebody got Kingston, Ontario, or something. Yeah. No, it's not going to work that way.
But I think there's something to be said here. There's something of if you are under 12 and male, or let's say over 30 and still have a just a wild, crazy ego, the existence of Canada separate from America on a map can be offensive.
That's true.
You know?
That's true.
So that might,
I'm glad you said that because I don't have to. Mark said that. Absolutely. And don't think I didn't feel it when I was having my problems with the Canadian bureaucracy. It's like, anyway.
But I just want to, before we close this Canada discussion out, and I feel like maybe we should get a friend of the show, Dan Bickner, on to talk about an invasion. But we did have a little back and forth, and he's like, you know, you'd be surprised that there would be a lot of people who would support it. Because there was that poll. It was something like 14% said they wouldn't mind being taken over by America. And I was like, 14%? And you know, he divides Canadians between the oafs, which is most of them, and the oaf overseers, the overseers who keep the oafs in line. And he thinks the overseers would be largely in favor of it, but the oafs would fight back. So it would be a tough, unconventional war, I think, is the point.
A lot of people where I used to live in British Columbia, it's not that they're particularly pro-American, but I remember one of them, when drunk, telling me, I'm only patriotic about the Alberni Valley. The rest of the place can go to hell. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of that in Canada, you know, like very, very local stuff.
Right.
But one of the biggest battles in the first year of the war is at sea, where, and I can't really stress enough the stunning nature of this outcome for a contemporary audience. The USS Constitution, Old Ironsides, as it came to be called, defeats HMS Guerrière in one-on-one naval battle on the open sea. That had not happened in quite a while. Occasionally, some British ship of the line would get defeated, but usually there was some sort of, you know, mitigating circumstance. Not this time. It was just straight up fight, and they lost. Because in some way, I don't know, I think it's like the Anglos are starting to dominate. I mean, you can't avoid that, but the question is, which Anglos? And the American Anglos don't feel any sense of inferiority toward the British, and that makes the British in some ways very nervous. Although they were soon to learn a sense of inferiority all over again after the land battles. The USS Constitution goes on to defeat other vessels, the Java. And this starts to make Britain a little nervous. So finally, very belatedly, Britain declares war on the United States. They don't really want to because we're kind of busy here, fellas.
At first the U.S. declares war and the Brits aren't really paying attention to it much.
But they don't want to. It's like we've got this, you know, French problem. And I mean, after World War II, the French were sort of minimized and became rather unfairly a laughingstock in the Anglo world. But there was no such belief in the Anglo world around 1812. I mean, a French force would be at least the equal of any other force, Prussian, English, Russian, whatever. Yeah, so Britain finally declares war at the beginning of January, but that means that they are beginning to devote some attention to the war on land. And that war is hopeless for the United States. It's like, especially in the Michigan Territory, which was quite important. There were a lot of battles there. The British also have the cooperation of the Native Americans of the Northwest Forests, and that's crucial because the Americans had managed to alienate those people who knew the land better than anybody else.
Right.
It was an axiom of the French and Indian Wars, as they're called in the Anglo world, that the French were worth 3 English in the forest, but the English were worth 3 French on the battlefield. And that was mainly because at that time, the French had a lot of cooperation from non-Iroquois tribes. So there's a lot of indecisive naval battles in the year 1813 and a lot of debacles. I mean, utter debacles on land for the United States. Mm. One of the most interesting incidents in the lead up to the campaign for Washington, D.C., which is the big battle of 1814, aside from New Orleans, is the burning of Frenchtown. Not a Frenchtown, actually, a small village at the top of Chesapeake Bay. By the way, the landscape of Chesapeake Bay is endlessly complicated. I don't claim to understand it. The British used it very, very well because they had the dominant navy down south. And I'll never quite understand, after seeing what they did, why the Union didn't use it as effectively during the Civil War, except, you know, what are you going to do? McClellan, Burnside, you're going to, you know, mount amphibious operations with them. McClellan tried it once and got chased back and wrote a teary letter to Washington. But anyway, so the British are not shy at this point. They're in a bad mood, really, because usually they take it easy on the U.S. It's important to remember that. Mm. These were their people. They were white. They were Protestant. They were English-speaking. You had to have all those characteristics if you were going to encounter any leniency from British regulars. I mean, what happened in 1798 in Ireland, you know, it was like, okay, they were white. They were probably whiter than anybody with that Irish climate. Some of them were Protestant, but it didn't seem to make much difference. They were English-speaking, some of them, the upper class anyway. But 1.5 is not the same as 3. You had to be all 3 things, white, English-speaking, Protestant. Mm. The American colonists fulfilled all 3 of those. And so they were treated relatively leniently by the British Army, except in a few cases like Tarleton in the Carolinas. And even then, Tarleton's, this is Banast Tarleton, a spoiled fop of the empire. And by the way, those spoiled fops were nobody you wanted to mess with. They were very, very foppish, but they could turn on a dime and gut you. However, they turned into caricatures and very exaggerated caricatures. Mel Gibson made an American Revolution movie in which Tarleton locks the whole inhabitants of a town in a church and then says, burn the church, which is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Didn't happen. Yeah. Wouldn't happen. Other places, yes, but not the United States. But anyway, the great thing about burning Frenchtown, and it was not the kind of burning where, you know, you throw people into their houses and then burn them. You get them out, then you burn it. It was carried out by Rear Admiral George Cockburn. Mm-hmm. And the Cockburns take great pride in this.
Oh, yes.
The Cockburns who have been guests on Radio Warner many times.
Yeah, Andrew Cockburn, Patrick Cockburn, both have been guests on the show. I used to write for Alexander Cockburn and used to be in contact. He was, and he's written about their direct, you know, the great, 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 whatever, grandfather. And they're very proud that he burned down Washington, D.C. And they never fail to mention it. And who wouldn't, you know? Before we move on from 1813, I just want to make a quick hometown shout out here because there was a little something going on at Fort Niagara. So that's, you know, hour and a half west of here along the, you go, it would be west all the way to the far west of Lake Ontario and then to the north of Lake Erie, where Niagara Falls is. And Fort Niagara was an American fort. It was one of those forts that in the peace deal after the Revolutionary War was given to the Americans. And it sounds like, you know, with everything, I think the financiers, the money people also, like they cared, like now, they cared a lot more even then about building up a Navy. Navy meant big contracts. And because even Fort Niagara was kind of falling to pieces by the time the War of 1812 starts. But it is really well situated. I went there. I took my kids to a reenactment there, and it was really cool. They did a very large scale with muskets and blanks, and you know, people dying. And it was very well done. The fort is done. But my point is this: from that fort, from artillery from that fort, they were able to sink, I don't know, a small Royal Navy ship, and so the Brits were pissed off. And also, I think they did a raid into Canada from there in Newton. So that was, you know, that meant war. And I was reading about it. The Brits took the fort in the end of 1813. And the way they took the fort was, the fort was defended by almost 400 Americans. And the Brits came with less than 600. And those should be terrible odds for taking the fort.
Absolutely. That thing was massive.
Yeah. So, and I'm reading about this, it's kind of incredible, but this is what happened. They brought scaling ladders, and you know, they assumed they were going to have to sneak up in the middle of the night and charge with bayonets and basically surprise them. But before they even launched it, there was an advance party that went up to the gate, you know, one of the main gates, and the sergeant, the British sergeant, basically affected a Southern American accent. And wow. I guess they were Southern even then. And that confused the guard long enough to gain entry. And the Brits went in and massacred the Americans. Anywhere from 60 to 80 were killed and took the fort and then used that as a sort of beachhead to sack and burn Buffalo. But can you imagine, like, man, hey there, partner, you know, can you can you help a fellow American out there? You know, I mean, and it worked. Oh. So you were not talking about the sharpest sticks either in the American land force.
Oh, yeah. My God. Well, yeah. I hope he felt bad before he got bayoneted to death.
Yeah. So moving on to 1814, which is the monumental year, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Things kind of come to a head then. Partly because Napoleon has to go and ruin things by going into Russia and destroying the best army Europe had ever seen. And I'll get a lot of flack for that, but I still say so. And the British army, which had really been pounded into shape by years of war, right, was available, and thousands of troops were now getting decanted into North America through the Canadian ports. So the capital is Washington, D.C. The British, very addicted to these two-pronged assaults in North America. One goes down from the lakes, doesn't do very well. The other one goes up from Chesapeake Bay, and there are three possible lines of attack. The brilliant American politicians who are getting involved in the defense of Washington, D.C. This is another horrible American tradition. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, this ruined Grant's plans half the time in the U.S. Civil War. The administration in D.C. was desperate to avoid having the city taken, which really might not have been such a disaster, but they insisted that Grant pose the Army of the Potomac between D.C. and Lee's forces. Grant wanted, to his credit, and he doesn't get credit for this, Grant wanted to just veer off into rural Virginia and then just say, come and get me. And by that time, it was pretty clear that the tactics were moving toward the defense, and that would have been a disaster for Lee, as it was at Gettysburg. But he really wasn't allowed to do that. So the politicians interfere in the War of 1812 as well. And in this case, it's a future president James Madison on the field of Bladensburg, who decided that the American militia and the few regulars who were part of the defending force had been positioned wrong. And this is one of the great lessons of early American militia warfare and probably militia warfare in general. That is, you do not take amateur soldiers or citizen soldiers, as they were called, and make them do complicated marches just when the battle is about to start. That is an absolute recipe for disaster. What you do is get them to dig in, and if need be, you chain them to the trenches, and you just tell them, stay there until you die, because then they will fight, and they can do that. If you demand anything more from them, like complicated maneuvers, it's going to be a disaster. I mean, this was the classic story of the Franco-Prussian War, where a bunch of geniuses, at least in their own imaginations, like McMahon, decided that they could take conscripts who had very little training and make them march all over the countryside and converge in some triple-double reverse on the Prussian army. And the Prussian army just sort of waited for them to converge and then just punched them in the head. And that was that. But anyway, Madison tries to say, no, 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 you're positioned wrong. Go away from your trenches and assume a new position somehow. Well, first of all, his new position was wrong. The British were coming straight down the line to D.C., and he thought they were going to move east to Baltimore. Absolutely wrong. Mm. And worse yet, they were being forced to move out of their positions, move all their artillery. And you just can't do that with raw troops. So the British had good commanders, for one thing. That was probably the main good troops, good commanders. Cockburn and Cochrane were the two commanders. And those are both Scottish names. And that's usually a good sign. If, you know, you're betting on a British army in the late 18th century. Some of the aristocratic British commanders were nepotism hires, and they were not so good. But two Scots were going to know what they were doing. So Cochrane was the admiral. Cockburn was the general. They did their jobs extremely well, and unlike many, many, many generals, they didn't hate each other with a passion, and they cooperated. So Bladensburg is a complete debacle. American forces ran, and the Bladensburg races was a famous sarcastic reference for it. And the British soon march in and occupy Washington, D.C. D.C. is not, at this point, a metropolis, but it was the capital, and it was a national humiliation to have it sacked. And Cockburn sacked it in a rather witty, vengeful way. There had been an American newspaper that was libeling him day after day, and he had copies of it. And when he allowed his soldiers to sack this newspaper's offices, the first thing he did was to tell them to take all the capital C's out of the typeface inventory so that the bastards couldn't insult him anymore. You know, and then he burned it, of course. So he was covered either way. And they burned the White House. There's a famous legend that Dolly Madison, I think, was saving pictures, going around saving pictures. It was probably slaves who did that, household slaves, rather than Dolly Madison.
Right.
And the burning of Washington was a shock. the United States got a lot less enthusiastic after that, and they realized how much territory they had to defend and how difficult it would be to defend it against a force that had the best ships in the world and the best Marines in the world. It really wasn't going to be possible.
Before we move on, I just want to mention here real quickly one of the articles from your series that you did for NSFW Corp, The War Nerds, 12 Days of 1812, and this was on the Battle of Bladensburg. And, I mean, you know, you make roughly the same points again. It's a very funny piece. It always stuck with me. I love your description here of James Monroe. You know, just to make damn sure we were doomed, another cook arrived to make sure the military broth was spoiled. James Monroe, Secretary of State and future president, one of those short guys who always have to be giving orders, showed up and started messing with Stansberry's dispositions as if these confused militia troops weren't already confused enough, sending them here and there like he was playing chess. You do not play chess with militia. Like a lot of battles, this one was a matter of deployment. The few minutes of actual noise and smoke were one of those foregone conclusions, like a Raiders game. Now, I was wondering, because back 10 years ago, as well as today, the Raiders lose every game. So, you know, but of course, when we were kids, it was a different story. But
but they were always, I mean, I remember them as, as you said, it depended on whether Stabler owed some bookies some money.
Yes.
Because it was always possible they were going to lose big and shamefully, even in their glory days.
Yep.
But 10 years ago, they were.
Yeah, they were just crap. Yeah. And today. But you you point out here this poem commemorating it, the Bladensburg Races, about the yellow-bellied sprint towards our nation's capital. It's one of the few cheery, I'm going to read this, a few cheery bits about this battle. It focuses on President Madison, who'd graced the battlefield with his presidential presence. That meant that two presidents were on the field that day, since Madison, the man who did as much as anyone to make sure we lost, was also among the sprinters heading for home. The poem does a great job of commemorating both these skedaddlers. And here's a little quote from the poem you have here. So like an arrow swift he flew, shot from an archer's bow, so did he fly, so after him as swift did fly Monroe. Six gentlemen upon the road beheld our general ride, Monroe behind, the chapeau gone, the broadsword by his side. As you point out, when you remember what ridiculous hats these gentlemen wore circa 1814 and how naked they felt without one, that's a great detail, the chapeau gone.
I think 1814 was probably the high point of stupid clothes for all of recorded history. I mean, there's something kind of cool about those three-cornered hats and some of those Revolutionary War costumes. Although, personally, I would kind of hate to have to wear those white waistcoats with the blue coat on top that opened up to reveal whatever belly you had and make it look even bigger. But things got so much worse in 1814 or so. I mean, all those choking high collars and all that. Ugh. So the consolation prize before the truce talks was a kind of strange one. And I don't know if we have really time to go over it fully, but that was, of course, the Battle of New Orleans, one of the strangest battles in any history. I've actually talked before about the song that kids of my generation all learned. In 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. That was a song by a guy named Jimmy Driftwood, who taught high school in Arkansas and used this song to teach his students about the Battle of New Orleans. It's a really brilliant song. And then, of course, there was a Canadian parody of it, because Canadians have a weird kind of pride in their part in the War of 1812. I think it's a band called The Worms. their song is Them Hillbillies from Kentucky, dressed in green and red, left home to fight in Canada, but they returned home dead. It's the only war the Yankees lost except for Vietnam and also the Alamo and the Bay of Ham. The loser was America. The winner was ourselves. So join right in and gloat about the War of 1812.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
The Gulf of Ham, you know, the Bay of Pigs.
Right, yes. that's good, yeah.
But it was a stunning, stunning defeat for the British Army. They had 2,000 casualties attempting to march in formation up to an American force that did the sensible thing, as we talked about. You know, the sensible thing with troops you've assembled at the last moment who may know how to shoot but don't know much else about military science, as it's called, is to put them behind strong works and let them fire. And Andrew Jackson, who was the commander and a very fearsome guy, a scary, scary guy, put them behind cotton bales. And cotton bales are an amazingly effective bullet stopper. And they just mowed these soldiers down, these British regulars. British regulars were very good at holding formation and moving forward despite really desperate fire, but that didn't avail much in those circumstances. The casualty totals were astounding, like 2,000 versus 77, if I recall correctly. I mean, it was crazy. But this was officially after the negotiated end of the war.
Right, so after the Treaty of Ghent, like a month or two after the treaty, I guess. Yeah.
So it was sort of a bloody sort of team spirit victory for America.
I think for John Bull, for the British and their Canadian allies, it was cheating. And it may have been cheating, maybe cheated a little bit, but for the Americans, it was glorious. And it made Jackson, you know, a hero, and made him president at some point later. As we talked about Andrew Jackson a little bit, I mean, he was, the Trump people at least claimed to hold him up as their kind of right-wing populist hero, but the thing is, what Jackson was known for as president, aside, of course, from Trail of Tears and, you know, slaughtering Native Americans, but he took down the bank. He took down finance. Right. And probably crashed the economy doing it, but it's what people wanted. It was democracy. And Trump, the Andrew Jackson of our time, he just basically gutted this one agency whose only job is to protect Americans from predatory bank lending practices. And first Elon closed it down, and then Trump, I think, just announced he's putting some used car dealer in charge of it. So a little different from Andrew Jackson, but
it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And it's too bad too, because Jackson could have taken Trump with anything from pistols to thumb gouges. It's a shame.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Trump would have said, it would have challenged him to a game of golf. And I think at that point, the golf club would have gone in and
absolutely
out and in and out. Yes, several times.
Four!
Yeah. So.
And on that happy note,
on that happy note, we could end the glorious War of 1812. America lost, but had a good ending anyway. It was fun for all, I think, for the most part. And I'm going to try and find a way to post links to the 12 Days of the War of 1812 series that John did, because like a lot of things from the Pando and NSFW days, they've been wiped, that both of us have done from then. You know, they've been wiped from the internet. But I think I can find much, if not all of it, at least much of it, and post some links to that for people. Or we could put it together as a little Warnerd book, you know, one of the...
Yeah.
for the 500th episode.
Yeah, and we'll
episodes.
Just hand it to subscribers for free.
Yeah, that's a good idea, actually. As our gift for 500 episodes, let's do that.
So thanks everybody for a really glorious era. I mean, it saved me from a long decline. So thanks.
Yeah, we are eternally grateful. And thanks for helping build a great show and a great community. And here's to 500 more shows. Are you ready?
Yeah, sort of.
I know. All right. Thanks, everyone. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.